Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stash Ziolkowski.
Today is Monday, July 24th, 2023. Our theme is Greek gods and goddesses, and probably some affiliated ordinary people as well. Well, and heroes and heroines. But Greek gods and goddesses. How are you, Stash?
I'm fine. We've had a lovely couple of days. Terry and I have coffee on our patio every morning, unless it's raining or something. But even when it's raining, we have an umbrella so we can sit out there. And then in the evening, we usually have a cocktail and sit on a patio. And so we have these two anchor points in the day where we just, you know, no screens, no books or anything. We just sit and talk to each other about what's going on. And
Sounds lovely.
It is really lovely. And I have fun making up stuff about the things that go by, you know, because it's nice. We have a quiet neighborhood, but I have started to make up this kind of story that when we go out to have our coffee or a drink, that there is a group that has just made up their mind that they're going to entertain us. And so they'll have a certain car pass by at just the right time. And then somebody will walk by near the trees and just enough to give us some background stuff so that we can have interesting conversation about that.
Talk about your neighbors.
Yeah, and we repeatedly say, let's not talk about the neighbors. But because the people doing it, because the people that are doing this thing for us are not neighbors. They're people that are professionally hired artists and performers that have a car sitting behind a tree waiting for us to be in our places. And then the director says to them quietly, off in the distance, okay, go. And then the car drives by slowly, and you know, stuff like that.
Huh. You lead a very interesting life, Mr. Ziolkowski.
Yeah, well, I know. People keep trying to entertain me all the time.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Andy Alfred Irwin for opening the show with Tarry Here, his original composition, and yes, making us so professional to have that wonderful original art open our show.
So,
would you like to talk about some?
I would. And the August Speak Story Concert, oh boy, is going to be wonderful. August 8th and 9th. And this is going to be one of those concerts, if you can make both days, you should really try. Because we're going to have Dolores Hydock, who is taking the place of someone else who was taking the place of someone else. So Dolores was in the lineup for next year, but luckily Adam was able to get her to come this year. So on August the 8th, Dolores is going to do a story that the title of it says, Tony Curtis speaks Italian and all I can say is I love you. And it's two friends headed off to Europe for a year. They got home, but only one came back. A true story of a friendship derailed for 40 years until it's rescued by Google. What if you could meet your 19-year-old self again? I'm looking forward to that. Because I often think what it would be like to be able to maybe, I don't know, meet, but stand in the room with my 19-year-old self and watch what I would do.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And on Wednesday, August 9th, she's going to do a story of a medieval warrior woman. It's a wickedly funny, plot-twisting tale of greed, lust, deceit, revenge, and the rewards and sacrifices that come from finding your true voice. And the title of it is Silence. So I'm looking forward to that, because I think she, well, I know she has a great reputation, and she's won lots of awards, and she's been around for a good while. And I'm looking forward to hearing her.
Excellent. I don't think I've ever heard her. I've heard good things about her.
But yeah, and I don't think I've heard her in person either. So I'm really glad that Adam knows these people and can bring them to entertain us.
Okay, and, well, I'm gonna don't let me forget that after we tell a story or two, I'm gonna talk about stories in the round.
Oh yes, you better.
And probably talk about August as well.
Okay.
Okay. Do you want to go first?
Yeah. How about that? Okay. And I think I said I have a smattering.
Smatterings are good.
Yeah. So, here we go. Greek mythology has left us with invaluable heritage of tales with envious gods, courageous heroes, epic adventures, and stories of vengeance and love. The corpus of Greek mythology is immersed, and we would need several volumes of books to cover most of the stories. However, as it is natural that some of those stories are more beloved than others. So here's a bit of a, what I called it before, an abridgment of the most famous tales from Greek mythology. So, and if I should start talking about something that you're going to talk about later, say, stop, desist, and go away. Okay. So, the beginning of this is interesting. It says, theogony, which is a word I never heard before. I can't believe it, that I never heard that word that's in this thing. So, according to Hesiod's Theogony. In the beginning, there was only chaos. Dense darkness covered everything until the earth was born out of chaos. And the mountains, the sea, and then the sky with the sun, the moon, and the stars, and then Uranus and Earth came together and gave birth to the Titans. But Uranus was afraid that one of his children would take his throne. That is why he enclosed every one of them in the depths of the earth. But his son Cronus, the strongest of the Titans, defeated him and became world leader. He married Rhea, who gave birth to two gods and three goddesses, Hades, Poseidon, Hera, Hestia, and Demeter. I would say that wrong. How do you say Demeter?
I say Demeter.
Okay, Demeter, sorry. Every time I see that, I say to myself, I said, Demeter, okay. But Cronus inherited the fear of his father and believed that one of his offspring would later take his throne. So when they were born, he swallowed them. However, Rhea was expecting a sixth child and fearing it would share the same fate with her other children, she secretly gave birth on a mountain in Crete and hid the newborn there. She named the child Zeus. She also tricked Cronus into thinking he swallowed this child too by giving him a stone wrapped in swaddling clothes. I'm guessing that he's not too bright, which Cronus swallowed thinking it was his newborn. The nymphs took care of Zeus and fed the boy with the milk of a goat. When he grew up, Zeus found his father, tricked him into, boy, I keep losing my place. Man, I'm so sorry. I keep having a problem with my pages.
Just keep going.
Okay. I didn't want to leave that alone. But Okay. The nymphs took care of Zeus. When he grew up, Zeus found his father and tricked him into drinking a mixture of wine and mustard, which caused him to disgorge the contents of his stomach. Zeus's older brothers and sisters came out of Cronus fully grown. This is how the great Titan monarchy began. The war between the Titans and the gods, with Zeus as their leader. This titanic battle lasted for 10 years. The gods defended the Titans and threw them into Tartarus, a dark and gloomy place as far from the earth as earth is from the sky. Then the gods fought with the giants for the dominance of the world. This gigantic Machi lasted a long time as well, but the gods were again victorious. Thus Zeus became the ruler of the whole world, and he and the other gods settled in Olympus. In Greek mythology, the Morai are the three goddesses of fate, Clotho, Lachesis, and Anthropos. The three sisters weave the fate of humans and gods alike. Neither humans nor god has the power to influence or question their judgment and actions. Clotho, the youngest one, spins the thread of life. She is the very origin, the creation of life itself, and her thread is spun upon the birth of a person. Lachesis, the second sister, is the one that allocates the fate of people during life. The name comes from the Greek word, which I can't pronounce, which means to obtain from lot. In that sense, one can understand that their destiny is chosen out of a myriad of possibilities. It is said that Lachesis measures the thread of life with her rod, determining its length and nature. The last sister of fate is Atropos, the unturning. Atropos is the cutter of the thread of life with her shears. With her shears, she determines how someone will die. Are you ready to tell?
I am ready to tell.
Okay.
And my story concerns Zeus as well. In the tales, oh, I should say before I start that I'm using several sources. So I'm using mostly Edith Hamilton, but also some Bulfinch, some other minor writers. In the tales of the ancient Greek gods and heroes, Minos was the king of Crete and the son of the great god, the Olympian Zeus and Europa. Many people tell the story with two kings called Minos, the original king of Knossos on the island of Crete, called Minos the first. This Minos was the son of Zeus from Europa, the young daughter of the king of Sidon, a port city of Phoenicia. Abducted by Zeus in the form of a beautiful and powerful bull, Europa rode across the sea on the back of the bull to the city of Knossos, where Zeus himself had lived as a child, as you just explained to us in your story, Stas. After arriving in Crete, Europa gave birth to sons by Zeus, Minos, Rhadamanthus, and Sarpedon. Minos and Rhadamanthus lived exemplary lives, beloved in their kingdoms, and so esteemed by the Olympians. They were given the great honor of being judges of the underworld. This Minos the first had one son, Lycastus, who succeeded him as king of Crete. Lycastus had a son named Minos after his grandfather. But this Minos, Minos the second, was a far more flawed and complex character. This Minos is an important figure in the stories of Theseus, the Minotaur, Daedalus, and Icarus, Glaucus, and Nisus. Minos II fathered at least six children, Androgeus, Catreus, Deucalion, Ariadne, Phaedra, and Glaucus, all by his wife, Pasiphae. Through his son, Deucalion, he was the grandfather of King Idomeneus, who led the army of Crete in the Trojan War. So these children and grandchildren have their own sagas in the epic tale of the Iliad, or in later Greek and Roman oral and written literature. On ancient coins from Crete, Minos is shown with a beard, wearing a crown on his curly hair, with a stern and dignified visage, resembling the traditional portraits of his father Zeus. Most often he appears on household and ceremonial vessels and on bas-relief stonework and murals with his brothers Aeacus and Rhadamanthus as judges of the underworld, or in paintings that show him with the Minotaur and Theseus. In Michelangelo's famous fresco, The Last Judgment, on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, Minos appears as a judge of the underworld surrounded by a crowd of devils with his tail coiled around him and two donkey ears, a symbol of stupidity. Minos judges the damned as they are brought down to hell. And if you want that whole story, that's in the second circle of the Inferno. The most well-known story of Minos is the one that intersects with the exploits of the great Athenian hero Theseus. The Athenians were not fond of Minos, and Theseus, as their hero, was so beloved by Athens that the saying in Athens has been, "Nothing without Theseus," meaning no great enterprise could be attempted without the help and blessing of that hero. Theseus was the son of the Athenian king, Aegeus, but his youth was spent in his mother's home city in the south of Greece. Before Aegeus left his beloved there, he placed a sword and a pair of shoes in a hollow and covered them with a great stone. He told his wife that when Theseus was strong enough to move the stone and collect the items under it, she might send him to Athens to claim his paternity. Theseus moved the stone when he was very young, and his mother found him a ship and a guide. But the young man refused this option, which he saw as too safe. And that pretty much describes the rest of Theseus's life. He was always taking the scariest, most heroic path. And he decided to travel the more dangerous, much longer route overland across many desolate lands rife with bandits, because he wanted to make a name for himself quickly. And he was sure that this was the best way to do it. His long and violent journey to Athens for the first time was filled with confrontations with these bandits, but in the end, he annihilated all of them and created freedom and safety for travelers along these roads for many years. And all of Greece spoke of this valiant and effective warrior who had made the roads safe for travelers. But not everyone was pleased with these stories of the brave young man. The Athenian king, Aegeus, had married Medea. And Medea was ambivalent about the stories about Theseus. Aegeus, who did not know the youth was his own son when he heard these stories of the young man who decimated the bandit community and made the road safe for everyone, he was concerned about losing his throne to this upstart. So he was also uncomfortable with the legends that were developing around Theseus. He had never met the boy. He had left his first wife behind before Theseus was born. So Medea knew of Theseus's paternity through her sorcery, and she was worried about losing her influence with the king to this upstart son. Medea determined to poison Theseus and convince the king that he should help, that Theseus was trouble and should be gotten rid of. When Theseus finally arrived at the palace, he was greeted and she handed the youth a welcoming cup of poisoned wine. And Theseus was about to drink it when King Aegis suddenly recognized the sword that Theseus carried and dashed the cup to the ground. Now, Edith Hamilton, in her book, Mythology, Timeless Tales of Gods and Heroes, says Medea escaped, as she always did, and got safely away to Asia. And then she picks up the tale with a recap of the terrible misfortune of decades past, when Minos, the powerful king of Crete, got into a lot of trouble and caused a lot of pain and heartbreak for a lot of other people. The Minotaur was a monster, half bull and half human, the offspring of Minos's wife, Pasiphae, and a wonderfully beautiful bull. Now, Poseidon had given this bull to Minos so that Minos could sacrifice this animal to him. Poseidon is the god of the sea. But Minos could not bear to slay the bull. It was such a fine-looking animal, and he kept it for himself. When Poseidon realized this, he determined that Minos was deserving of a terrible punishment, and he caused Pasiphae, his wife, to fall madly in love with the bull. When the Minotaur was born from that union, Minos the king did not kill him. He had Daedalus, a great architect and inventor, construct a place of confinement for the half-man, half-bull, stepson of the king, from which escape was impossible. Daedalus built the labyrinth, which became famous throughout the world. Once inside, one could go endlessly along its twisting paths without ever finding the exit. To this place, the young Athenians, the seven youths and seven maidens who were tribute from Athens to Knossos and Crete, every 9 years, the result of Minos's attack upon Athens in revenge for warriors that they had killed in their attack upon Thebes. And Minos was not really originally involved in that war, but he became involved because the Thebans called upon him for help when their warriors were about to be slaughtered by the Athenians. And so every 9 years after that, the Athenians were forced to pay tribute in the form of 14 young people, seven virgins and seven warriors, young warriors, who were taken to the labyrinth and sacrificed to the Minotaur, who tear them limb from limb and eat them alive. If these youth tried to escape, whatever direction they ran in, they might be running straight into the monster because it was such a maze. There was no way to tell where you were inside the labyrinth and no way to tell how to get out. But this time, once Theseus had reached Athens, it was the time for the next installment of the tribute. And Theseus came forward and offered to be one of the victims. Now, all of Athens loved him for his goodness and this willingness to sacrifice himself, but they had no idea that he intended to try to kill the Minotaur. He told his father that, though, and he promised Aegis that if he succeeded in killing the Minotaur, he would have the black sail which the ship with its cargo of misery, the 14 Athenians, always carried when they sailed to Crete with their youth. He would have the sail changed to a white one so that Aegis could know long before it came to land that his son was safe. When the young victims arrived in Crete, they were paraded before the inhabitants on their way to the labyrinth. Minos's daughter, Ariadne, was among the spectators, and she fell immediately in love with Theseus as he marched past her. She sent for Daedalus, the inventor, the architect of the labyrinth, and told him he must show her a way to get out of the labyrinth. And then she sent for Theseus and told him she would bring about his escape if he would promise to take her back to Athens and marry her. As may be imagined, Theseus had no problem with that. This woman was the daughter of a king and beautiful. And with the clue that she gave him from Daedalus and a ball of thread, which he was to fasten at one end of the inside of the door to the labyrinth and unwind as he went on. This he did, and certain that he could retrace his steps whenever he chose, he walked boldly into the maze looking for the Minotaur. He came upon him asleep, and pinning him to the ground, with no other weapon than his fists, he battered the monster to death. So that's where I'm going to stop, having talked for a long time. Most of that is from Edith Hamilton, verbatim. Well, the second half, the part about Theseus. But there were some other people in there, other writers in there as well. And I grew up with those stories, of course. My mother spoke ancient Greek, at least a bit of it, and Latin. And she would often read to me those stories. So they were favorites. You are muted, Mr. Z.
And the screen has changed on my new iPad. I can touch the screen and then I just unmuted myself. But as soon as I did that, the screen just goes back to you and nothing else on it. The chat stuff and all is removed. So I have to touch the screen each time I want to do something. I'm guessing you can hear me now.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right, good. So, I wanted to do a little blurb about Stories in the Realm. I could do about Stories in the Realm, but you do it much better. So, anyway, because I want to mention that in September, Diane Macklin is going to do a story based on a piece of commissioned art. There was a nationwide search which resulted in Diane Macklin's brand new story, Zora Unveiled, Echoes of a Cultural Muse, which will receive its world premiere in September. A large number of people who had applied for that commission, and Diane Macklin was chosen by a committee and also based on answering questions about what she was going to do and stuff. So that's exciting because Diane Macklin is a well-known storyteller, and I know we've both heard her a number of times and been in workshops with her. And I'm looking forward to this unveiling of this commission piece. That'll be on September 12th and 13th.
Pretty excited about that too.
I think that's going to be I'm sure it'll be a wonderful performance because she's always entertaining and always interesting. All right. So here we go.
Well, wait a minute. Let me talk about Stories in the Round first.
Yes, of course. Thank you for stopping me.
This evening, Jane Dorfman will be portraying Calamity Jane, and you can come and hear her do that at 1 3245 Seafoss Pike, the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hagerstown, $15, and 7 p.m. And we have snacks, as well as a wonderful, wonderful audience. And Jane, this is Jane's first time back with us since, I think, 5 or 6 years ago was the last time she told stories at Stories in the Round. And I'm looking forward to that. And then in August 28th, I will be telling stories about my mother and her time as a WAC in World War II. Same time, same place. Okay, tell us another story, Stosh.
Okay. I'm not muted anymore, right?
That's correct.
Good. And can you give me a time check?
We have been telling stories and rambling on for 30 minutes and 30 seconds.
Okay. All right. I wasn't sure. Okay, good. So here we go. Prometheus and the Theft of Fire. One day, Zeus distributed gifts to all the gods, but he didn't care much for the humans. The Titan, Prometheus, however, because he loved and felt sorry for humans, climbed up on Olympus and stole the fire from Hephaestus's workshop. He put it in a hollow reed and gifted it to the humans. This way, humans could create fire, warm up, and make tools. Zeus became very angry when he heard about this. He took Prometheus to a high mountain in the Caucasus, chained him on a rock with thick chains made by the smith god Hephaestus. And every day, Zeus would send an eagle that ate Prometheus's liver. For 30 years, Prometheus remained bound in the Caucasus until the great hero Hercules, or Heracles, depending on where you read about his heroic deeds, Zeus's demigod son, released him finally from his torment. In looking up the Greek myths and reading them, it is I am bound to comment that I can't tell which of the stories of the creation and gods and, you know, all these special people is scarier. The Islamic legends and religion, or the Christian religion, or the Greek myth. And I think the Greek myths are the more entertaining and less terrifying to some ways. Anyway, after Prometheus gave the fire to humans, Zeus decided to take vengeance. He ordered Hephaestus to create the first human woman out of soil and water. Each god gave the woman a gift. Athena gave her wisdom. Aphrodite gave her beauty. Hermes gave her cunning, and so on. The name of the woman was Pandora, meaning all gifts in Greek. Zeus gave Pandora a jar, warning her not to open it under any circumstances, and sent her to Prometheus's brother, Epimetheus. Prometheus had warned his brother not to accept any gifts from Zeus. However, Epimetheus accepted Pandora, who, although tried hard to resist the temptation, opened the jar and released all evils upon the world. Hatred, war, death, hunger, sickness, and all the disasters were immediately released. That sounds almost like one of those modern television shows. Here's a jar. And it's got all kinds of things in it, but you can't open it. and what you who's going to resist that? I would probably not even wait until I got into the next room. As soon as I made a turn, I would start to open it. Okay, here we go. The Abduction of Persephone by Hades. Persephone was the daughter of Demeter. Is that right? Demeter. Good. Okay. And Zeus. As Persephone grew, so did her beauty. When Hades, the god of the underworld, saw her, he immediately fell in love with her and decided to abduct her. According to the Homeric hymn to Demeter, one sunny day, the young Persephone was gathering flowers in a field, accompanied by her close friends, the ocean nymphs. The carefree Persephone moved away from her companions in search of the most beautiful flower. When she reached out to pluck a wondrous narcissus, Earth yawned open and Hades appeared in his golden chariot and snatched her away to the underworld while she was in tears. Demeter was looking in vain for her daughter day and night. The land and crops of the earth began to wither. After a while, the sun, looking at everything from the sky, felt sorry for the goddess and told her what happened. Demeter went to Zeus and demanded that Persephone be returned, or else she would not let the earth blossom again. Zeus sent the messenger god Hermes to Hades with the command to release Persephone. Before returning her to Hermes, Hades forced Persephone to eat 6 pomegranate seeds. Hades knew that if someone ate food in the underworld, they could never really escape the world of the dead. Persephone was shortly after reunited with her mother. However, Demeter was furious when she heard about the pomegranate seeds. Zeus then proposed a compromise. For every seed Persephone had eaten, she would spend a month with Hades. Demeter accepted Zeus's proposal. Thus, Persephone would travel to the underworld every 6 months, during which time Demeter would mourn and earth with her. But after 6 months, Persephone would return to her and Demeter would be happy again and earth would blossom once again. This story is part of the mythological explanation of how the Eleusinian mysteries were founded, the most sacred and secret religious rites of ancient Greece. And I, in a previous radio show a few years ago, actually, I remember you did a wonderful telling of the story of Persephone and with all the details. So the name giving of Athens. Cecrops, the first king of Attica, had named his city after him, Cecropia. Wouldn't it be fun to have a village named after me? Zeokowskiville. Or something. Anyway. However, the gods of Olympus saw this lovely piece of land and wanted to name it after them and become its patron. The most persistent rivals were Poseidon, the god of the sea, and Athena, the goddess of wisdom. To solve their dispute, Zeus decided that each of them would present a gift to the city and the people of Cecropia would decide which gift was best and therefore which god would be the patron of the city. So one sunny day, Cecrops and the residents of the city went up to a high hill to watch the gods presenting their gifts. Poseidon was the first to present his gift. He struck a rock with his trident and caused a spring of water to gush forth from the ground. This signified that he was assuring the citizens with water and therefore they wouldn't face any time of drought. However, the people were not exactly enchanted with his gift because the water from the spring was salty, just like the waters of the sea over which Poseidon ruled. Next, it was the turn of the goddess Athena. She struck her spear on the ground, and a lovely olive tree jumped out of the earth. The citizens liked this gift better because it would give them food. oil, and firewood. This is how Athena became the patroness of the beautiful city, and this is how Athens got its name according to Greek mythology. The hill where the gods presented their gifts was the Acropolis Hill. There is still an olive tree there, and some say it is the same tree Athena gifted to the ancient Athenians. You can discover more exciting stories about the Acropolis if you would care to travel to Greece and take the Acropolis mythology tour. Thank you.
That's great. Yeah. I have visited the Acropolis, but it was
many years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty impressive.
You've done just about everything.
Nah.
Well, I've never been to Greece.
I've never been to Poland.
Well, that's true.
That's so true. There.
Yeah. Okay. That's okay. Interesting, because Terry would like to go to Greece.
Me too. Well, if she should let me know when she's going, and maybe we
can. Oh, boy. Okay.
Okay, well, I'm going to finish a bit of the story of Theseus and his altercations with the gods. So we got up to the point where he had slain the Minotaur within the labyrinth. When Theseus lifted himself up from that terrific struggle, the ball of thread lay where he had dropped it, the ball that had been given to him by Ariadne as the key to escaping from the labyrinth. With it in his hands, the way out was clear. He simply followed the string back the way they had come. And the others followed, taking Ariadne with them. They fled to Theseus's ship and over the sea toward Athens. On the way there, they put in at the island of Naxos. And what happened then is reported differently in different accounts. One story says that Theseus deserted Ariadne. She was asleep and he sailed away without her. But Dionysus found her, comforted her, and they spent some time together after that. But the other story is much more favorable to Theseus. She was extremely seasick and he set Ariadne ashore to recover while he returned to the ship to work. A violent wind carried him out to sea and kept him there a long time. On his return, he found that Ariadne had died and he was deeply afflicted. That's Edith Hamilton's word. Now, both stories agree that when Theseus drew near to Athens, he forgot to hoist the white sail. Either his joy at the success of his voyage put every other thought out of his head, or his grief for Ariadne made him forget what he had promised. But the black sail was seen by his father, King Aegeus, from the Acropolis, where for days he had watched the sea with straining eyes. It was to him the sign of his son's death, and he threw himself down from a rocky height into the sea and was killed. The sea into which he fell was called the Aegean, after the king, ever after. So Theseus then became king of Athens, and to all reports was a most wise and level-headed king. He declared to the people that he did not wish to rule over them. He wanted a people's government where all would be equal. Now you begin to see why my mother would tell me the story of Theseus. He resigned his royal power and organized a commonwealth, building a council hall where citizens could gather and vote. The only office he kept for himself was that of commander-in-chief. Thus, Athens became, of all the earth's cities, the happiest and most prosperous, the only true home of liberty, and the one place in the world where people governed themselves. And it was for this reason that in the great war of the seven against Thebes, when the victorious Thebans refused burial to those of the enemy who had died, the vanquished turned to Theseus and Athens for help, believing that free men under such a leader would never consent to having the helpless dead wronged. They did not return to Athens in vain. Theseus led his army against Thebes, conquered the city of Thebes, and forced her to allow the Thebans, the army to be buried. But he refused to let his army enter and loot the city, as was traditional in wars at that time. He had not come to harm the Thebans, but to bury the Argive dead. And that duty done, he led his soldiers back to Athens. In many other stories, he shows the same qualities, and there are lots more stories about Theseus. But one of the things I did when I was getting ready for this show was to look up in Changa's Alka's book, Tales of Superhuman Powers, 55 traditional stories from around the world. Found stories about human beings who fly, because I started with the story of Daedalus and Icarus. And of course, Daedalus was the inventor and architect who built the labyrinth under orders of Minos, the king of Crete. But he also had other adventures in his time. He was a human being. And when Theseus freed the 14 youth from Athens from the labyrinth and slaughtered the Minotaur, Minos, the king, was positive that Daedalus must have given him the key to escape. And he had Daedalus and his young son, Icarus, locked up in a tower. There was no way out of the tower. It was surrounded by cliffs and sea, and Daedalus came up with a plan. He invented two sets of wings, one for himself and one for his young son, and built those wings from wax and bird feathers that Icarus helped him to collect on the roof of that tower. It took a long time, but they were successful in building those wings. And Daedalus gave his son strict instructions about how to fly, how to escape from the tower across the sea. But Icarus, as a young, romantic and headstrong young man, once he got his wings, instead of following close behind his father and staying at that level, not too close to the sea, where the mist from the sea might saturate the wings, and not too close to the sun, where the wax might well melt, he got so involved in the joy of flying that he reached for the sun. He tried to go higher and higher. The wax in his wings melted and he fell to his death. And that's one of the most memorable stories from ancient Greece that I remember from my youth. But there are other stories in Changa's Alka's book about people who fly. And she has some really interesting commentary about that. Maybe we'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, well, I wish I had thought of looking at that book. I have a copy of it right in my bookcase.
So. Of course you do.
Right.
She was an impressive storyteller when we heard her at Speak many years
ago. Oh, boy. Yeah. And she gave me permission to tell one of her stories when I heard her, because I had read one of her stories before we mm-hmm. met her. She was very nice. And I wonder if she was one of the people that I took to a school. I think she was.
What was the story that she gave you permission
to tell? Oh, good. Ask me to remember something.
Well, I would remember that if Changa Zalka had given me permission to tell.
Yeah, I would too, normally, but I don't remember things so well anymore. So,
if I read to you some of the titles of the book, would you remember?
I might.
Well, she has stories of superhuman strength, Janos and Rocha, and another one called Alderblock. Stories of invulnerability, Isfandiyar and the Fellow with the Goat Skin. Mm-hmm. Her two stories about flight, aside from Icarus and Daedalus, are The Winged Prince and People Who Could Fly. And The Winged Prince is a wonderful story about a mechanical horse and just really interesting story.
Yeah.
And then The People Who Could Fly is an African-American story, or an African story, a story that came from Africa but is told in this country by African-Americans, about people who escaped from slavery and legends of there was always the possibility that since some ancestors had wings, that people might learn to use their wings again and fly away from enslavement. There's Green Peter, the tale of Sir James Ramsay of Banff, Finn McCool and the Giants, and Three Critical Men. And those stories are all about heightened senses.
Finn McCool might be the story that I have told the stories of Finn McCool stories. So that might have been.
Yeah, Susan Gordon tells Finn McCool too.
Yeah, I can't rely on my memory. I'd have to look for notes or something.
I let you off the hook, but hopefully our listeners are so intrigued by all of these. I don't know, there's 55 traditional tales in Chinga Zolko's book, and maybe they will look it up.
Yeah. And she is a phenomenal storyteller. Very nice. And it strikes me that the Greek myths have, of course, been around a long time. And they are much more respected than the Marvel comic book characters, I think. They probably are not as well represented in modern movies as the Marvel comic book characters. However, I think they're more romantic in the way that the Greek myths have things happen out of the craziest combinations. You know, for Earth and Uranus to bump into each other and then create stuff, you know, is kind of weird since there's two planets and you know, who cares if I admire them, but I admire the Greeks' stories because they didn't let anything hamper their ability to tell a story. If they came upon a brick wall, or rather a stone wall, a mountain made out of solid stone, they just figured out a way to put a doorway in it or something like that, you know? and thinking about the myths, I couldn't help but relate the Hansel and Gretel to the ball of string. You know, when Hansel and Gretel are taken out into the woods and they leave stuff behind as they're walking so that they can find their way home again. It is just like that ball of string. In fact, and both of them, I anytime I've heard either one of those stories, I think, what if the birds would eat the stuff that they dropped on the ground? And what if, Theseus, was it, with the string, tripped and broke the string? And, you know, if you have string tied on something and you're going around the corners and this and that and the other thing, all you have to do is have it snap one time and it's going to go way away from you.
Right.
That string gets to be like just like a string on a guitar or something, you know, ching, and then who knows where it winds up. And that, you know, so both of those ways of finding your way back is treacherous, you know.
Yep, but it is a good story.
Oh yeah, sure. All the stories are good. You know, I mean, that's just like I would think a commissioned piece. This is just me, off the top of my head, a commissioned piece to create a new myth in the style of the Greek myths would be an interesting challenge for storytellers. You know?
Yep.
So, and I think it's great when people can create myths, like the thing we saw last month with Adam performing and telling the heron's journey. Because that is a modern myth now. I think it's a wonderful, you know, thing. And Adam has created something that is, I'm wondering, I have to ask Adam, I haven't talked to him since that performance, but I'm assuming that he may use that in his telling across the country. It's a, you know, wonderful story, but I wonder about traveling with seven herons and the mechanical stuff that goes with that. That would probably be better story to tell in schools or in a library with a large audience. So all the parts could be put together properly. Whereas on a stage like at Jonesboro or something like that, I can't imagine somebody in the audience being tasked with the herons flying and that. But it could be done, certainly. And especially with a person like Adam, who has such a wonderful way with people, and people always want to help Adam with stuff.
Yes.
You know, and I think most storytellers find that, you know, it would be hard to find a storyteller who isn't, you know, the kind of person that would like audience help in doing things. But
yeah, Jonesboro seems like there's too much going on there, and you're packed together too tight in the tents to make that easy.
Yeah, right. That would be good maybe for a children's tent. You know, if they had a tent for just young people.
Yeah, I don't know if Adam would be willing to have children handling his herons.
Well, it would depend on, you know, children's age. 16, I think, would be a decent age. So
I did want to mention one more source. Nathaniel Hawthorne's Wonder Book has a lot of these tales in it, and that was a source that I used too. Very different way of telling than Edith Hamilton or even Bulfinch.
Yeah,
I think we're out of time.
I believe you're right.
So I am going to say this is Fanny Crawford
and Stosh Steelkowski.
We've enjoyed being your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour today at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland, offering our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Casey.
The blues and moose.
The blues.